Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the fireside room, today's speaker is Fred McCandless. The title of his talk is What You See Is Seldom What You Get. Let's listen in on Fred McCandless.
We're talking about what you see is seldom what you get. Anybody have any idea what we're talking about? Non-WYSIWYG. Thank you very much. We have a computer person in the room. WYSIWYG is a computer term that is what you see is what you get. When you look at a screen, that's what comes out on your printer. It wasn't always that way. In fact, sometimes for me, it's still not that way. But they tell me it's supposed to be. What I'm going to tell you about today is a tool. How many of you here have heard of the Enneagram system, personality system at all? A couple of years ago? Okay. How many have not? Okay. That's fine. I'm going to be putting a diagram up here that you may have seen on books, you may have seen around. The Enneagram system was developed a long time ago and is really a way of understanding personality in a very different sense from how we normally understand it. The Enneagram is something that we do. It's a tool that helps us see more into ourselves to basically get a better handle on our actions and our activity in our lives so we stop sabotaging what we're doing. The first concept within the system is the concept of the three centers. In your handouts, there's a sheet that breaks these centers down with some values. The head center, the heart center, and the gut center. It's the interaction of these centers that motivate us, that create what we call our personality, which can be called it's better to be called a style. I don't think you so much have a personality as you do a personality. Deep down inside of us, at our core, we are very much different than we appear. People will use personality to push people away. We define this space, much like this fireplace here. At our core, we're something like this. But we create these layers in order to protect us. As children, this is a very necessary thing to do because the essence, the essential person, is pretty much hidden within and is very vulnerable. So we immediately begin putting up walls, screens, distractions to keep people at arm's length so we don't get extinguished. This is a very real fear that most children have. And as adults, we are taught, we learn how to parent by having parents. We learn to treat other people the way we're treated as children. And if I have a need as a child and that need is not being met, then I will find a way to get that need. The best way to do that is to do subtle manipulation. Now, I have a 9-year-old son, and I'm always subject to his controls, his control strategies. As far as he knows what he wants, and he tries to push my buttons to get this need met. How many have been through this? How many have not? Oh, good. Well, if you haven't, it's coming. And it starts when they're very young. The very first thing a child will do is cry. It's a very simple thing to do. But if crying, by crying and making loud noises, I can get my needs met. And later on, when I start to have other needs that I can get met as an adult, maybe I get those needs met by making a big noise. Maybe I get those needs met by being very much in your face and being really loud until you finally succumb and give me what I want. Now, when I'm a child, maybe all I want is attention. Maybe I want food. Maybe I want to be changed. I'm crying because there's a need. The needs are very few as children, but as we grow older, we assume other needs, things that we really want to have that we don't. The interaction of these centers basically tells us how we like to meet our needs. On the one sheet that talks about the three different center areas, the head center is dealing more with thinking, analyzing, critiquing, being linear, being logical. Some of us argue our way into getting what we want. We can come up with such a convincing series of statements that people will give in to us. Maybe what we're looking for is recognition, credibility. We want to be believed. In order to be believed, I have to do two things. Number one, I have to get you to trust me. And number two, I have to present a sound enough argument that you can't refute. So the head center really is dealing more with presenting information and analyzing information. The gut center is a more visceral center. It's more active. It's how we actually express. How dynamic are we? If we're pulled back, then our gut center may be a little less developed than one of the others. In the core of the Enneagram system, these centers and their interaction really determine how successful we can be with our personalities. Are we really good at getting our needs met, or are we just manipulating people into meeting our needs? Within the Enneagram, there are 9 different types or styles. These 9 different styles are what these other 3 sheets with the different statements refer to. Not all of these statements may apply to you, and statements within the other areas may apply to you. What tends to happen is when we develop personality, it develops very slowly. Now, some people say, oh, I know what personality my child has. He's a real extrovert. It's hard to say with children. Children go in and out of different things until they find a strategy that works for them. They end up doing a personality that will get those needs met and validate them as people. For example, within each one of these centers, you have 3 very distinct ways of identifying. On these sheets, you'll find type number 8, type number 5, type number 6. As you move around the circle, you'll see that the center that the number is closest to, that is a mixture of those 2 centers predominantly. There's going to be a dominant center. If I'm a dominant head-centered person, I might spend more time thinking and planning, gathering information, analyzing data, maybe I love to read. That doesn't necessarily mean that all head-centered people are readers, but typically that need to know, that need to have information, is something that the head really enjoys. As people, we're motivated by pleasure, what makes us feel good, or we're motivated by pain, what makes us feel terrible, and we tend to move away from that and toward the other. Away from pain, toward pleasure. To the extent that our needs are met, we feel good about ourselves. Our self-esteem goes up, our ego needs go down, and we don't have as much need to use our personality to get our needs met because the needs are already met. When that twists the other way and our ego is in threat, we're in a threatened position, somebody threatens our self-identity, then the self-esteem starts to go down, the ego needs go up, and then all kinds of compulsive behavior starts to come up, which are these habits that we've learned as children that solidify into compulsive behavior, which by compulsion, I mean something we don't have very much control over because we don't realize we're doing it. Much like when you're driving down the freeway and you're just driving. Okay, if we had to think about all the time, all the things we have to do, how much pressure to put on the gas pedal, how fast am I going, constantly doing and consciously thinking, okay, I've got to turn the car just a little bit this way to stay in the middle of the road. A lot of those body reactions that we experience while we're driving a car is automatic. It's what I call positive compulsive behavior. We do this because, you know, if we don't, we can't drive. However, we go through this state where we stop being awake. We're not really aware that we're driving. I've composed workshops driving down the freeway. Turn on the radio, go to sleep, and keep driving. How many have seen people driving down the freeway like that? How many have driven down the freeway like that? How many? Who's not admitting? Okay. That says something about your personality style. Okay. These 9 different types I'm going to give names to. Now, this is the symbol you may have seen, this circle with the 9 points. The origin of this symbol is unknown. Okay. Some people have said, well, it looks... Sorry, I don't know where that shadow's coming from. The origin of the symbol is unknown. A man named George Gurdjieff brought the Enneagram system, if you want to call it this, and it is a system, it's a technology. It's not, I don't think you can just take the system and say, aha, I recognize you, you are a number. It's a real dangerous thing to do. We are people and we're complex. We're much more complex than any system that could be invented. What this tool allows us to do is use it like a lens to sort of recognize where our personalities are. Which set of characteristics do we use most frequently? Where are we most comfortable? You may have characteristics reading through these sheets that you say, oh, I recognize I do this and this and this, and I enjoy this and this and this. Yeah, I seem to find myself in all of these types, all of these areas. And that's true. Every one of those areas applies to you. But there's going to be one that will predominate. where you will find yourself using it more than the others. It's more like every one of us is from a hometown. We may live in different places now. We're all at Holden Village. Every pathway that we're taking has brought us to this point in time today. But we're all from someplace. I grew up down in California. And when I moved to Seattle, I started looking at Seattle through the eyes of a Californian. Oh, this bridge reminds me of the Golden Gate. Or this section of town reminds me of this part of the Mission District. Or all these different things. But it was always in relation to what I had known before. So when we go into relationships, how many people have gone into relationships comparing the person you're now in relationship with to the person you were with relationship before? We tend to see things through our filters. And that's okay. To have these compulsions is an okay thing. The question to ask yourself is it helping you get through, or is it preventing you from getting through? If you have an argumentative style, say it's very analytical, and you can't really communicate with people who are very emotional, then until you learn to develop the ability to relate more emotionally, you will be hobbled by your unwillingness or inability to relate on that level. This is particularly noticeable with men and women. Typically, right now there's this big issue going on between how women communicate and men communicate, and please understand me, and why don't you listen to me the way I want you to hear me, and blah, blah, blah. And I think that culturally we are being kind of forced into saying, well, women are more emotional, men are more analytical. And I know a lot of women who are very analytical, and a lot of men who are very emotional, who get caught in this trying to live up to the cultural expectations of what's happening. Within this system, within the Enneagram, certain genders are supposed to be certain ways. But the Enneagram system is not gender specific. And I'm going to go around right now and go through the 9 different personality styles. And then I'm going to go around and talk about how their self-identity is. These are the different, if you want to call them categories, I really resist that term, but it's what I've got to use. The idea in these styles, okay, I'm going to start with the gut center. Now, if I do the overlay, and there's numbers on this, where's my other one? I'm going to throw this up here. Okay, you see how these work? It gets so confusing with the lines, I try not to do this much. Ignore the lines. The lines and the star don't mean anything at this point. Once you understand the styles, and you understand that when a person has high self-esteem, they tend to take on characteristics of a different style. They tend to be able to use those. It's sort of like you've gone around the Monopoly board and you've collected your $200 and you can go ahead. You haven't been sent to jail. You've been allowed to pass go. I'll start over with the gut center. And that starts with the number 8, 9, and 1. Okay, the champion is a primarily gut-oriented person. On your list of statements, you can see certain statements that this style uses to get their needs met. Or how they see themselves. Now, with personality, there's 2 things. There's how other people view us, and there's how we view ourselves. And although we may not view ourselves as being, for example, if I was a number 8, a champion, I may not view myself as being very controlling, or dominating, or abrasive, or in your face. But that's how other people might view me. So, again, one of the cautions in using the system is when you go to tell somebody else what type they are, because they say, oh, I recognize all these characteristics in you, you may accidentally put an overlay on top of them that's not right. That's an illusion. And so they think, well, geez, I must be this, because you're telling me I'm this, and you know more about this than I do. So be careful, again, in using the system, to use it on yourself first. And talk about other people, and talk with people who are trying to self-identify, and saying, "Well, I see myself this way. Do you agree? Just agree. Check in. We are our own best mirrors. Talk to the people you know. Think about your history, places you've been, situations you've been in, and look at the little things you do every day that help you figure out, oh, God, I really do this. I don't know that I'm doing it. Oh my God, I'm waking up. I didn't know I was doing that." The champion 8. Sees themselves as being in control. Their self-definition is, I am powerful. Now, That means that there's this tendency to live in a very small area and not worry too much about what's outside that area. But if anything comes into my circle of influence, as Steve Covey would say, then I'm gonna make sure they know who's in charge. An example of a type A personality might be Boris Yeltsin. Okay, here's a guy who's the whole Soviet Union's coming down around his ears about 3 years ago. And he looks around to see the nearest thing he can get onto to start talking to people, and it just happens to be a tank. And everybody's listening to this man. He's not so concerned that it's a tank. What's important to him is getting control. But the fact that it's a tank and he's talking to people with this sense of power, it's a very influential thing. And people say, God, what a dominating personality. What a strong leader. Most of the champion aides tend to be strong leader types, because their characteristics are, no matter what happens, I will push through it and make it happen, make it go my way. A typical champion phrase might be, my way or the highway. An example of the eights from cinema would be the character that Clint Eastwood plays in the Dirty Harry movies. You realize at the point where he's got the kid on the ground, he's got the gun pointed at him, and the kid goes, and he's shaking, and Clint Eastwood goes, well, in all the confusion, I can't remember if I fired 5 shots or 6. And you realize in that moment it doesn't matter, because the power isn't in the gun, it's in him. And he is so petrified, this other person, that it doesn't matter. The kid is completely washed out. And the kid says, I gotta know, and Clint Eastwood pulls the trigger, and there's nothing in the chamber. Telly Savalas is Kojak. Very intimidating, and his biggest weapon was a lollipop. And he'd come up, and take that out of his mouth, and tap you on the head with it. Total intimidation. He always wore a suit. Very big presence. The thing about the champion is that they have this huge presence that they use to get their way. They see themselves as being very self-reliant. I don't need anyone else. I can do it on my own. That's what they show. But inside, there's a very different story. There's this wanting to trust, this vulnerability. But they don't want to let it out. The combination of the centers is primarily gut, which is survival, safety, comfort, control. The secondary center is the head. I can validate, verify, and let you know this is why I'm doing this. I'm doing this because I know what needs to happen. Doing this, and I'll shoot first and ask questions later. The least integrated developed center is the heart center, which is the emotional connectedness to other people. It's hardest for the eight to let down that wall, to take off that suit of armor, and let you see that soft spot inside. The idea is that when they were younger, it was difficult for them to just be, to cry. These are the kinds of kids that are told, don't cry. You know, strong people, men don't cry. Don't cry. Stop crying. So this sensitivity, this part of them that they have, has been encased in this armor. Someone told me once the image of the champion eight is sort of like a burned marshmallow. Campfire. It's all crusty and charred on the outside, but it's all soft and mushy on the inside. Now, if there's any champion eights in the room, I'm sorry, I just gave away your big secret. But that's what our personalities do for us. They put us in this position of getting our needs met and trying to take care of that part that we have stuffed away. The negotiator nine is also known as the peacemaker or the mediator. And if you read different Enneagram books, you'll see that the different authors come up with different terminology. The point with the nine is that they are so immersed in the gut, and they're equidistant from the heart and the head. You think, well, what's their mixture? The point is that they're so gut-oriented. They tend to wait. They are probably very patient people. Patience is a virtue. But for the negotiator, patience is also a curse, because they will sometimes miss their windows of opportunity because they'd rather go with the flow, keep things on an equitable basis, and saying, this is no more important than that, because if this becomes more important, it creates an inner conflict. And the negotiators ignore it, but they avoid conflict as much as possible. So when you're talking to them, sometimes you're not sure if they're there. if they're talking to you, you're not really sure what's the most important thing is that they've said, because it all kind of sounds the same after a while. The example of George Bailey in It's a Wonderful Life, played by Jimmy Stewart. Here's this guy. He's just, everything's okay. He just has this ability to keep going and make things happen. But it's sort of like he just goes with the flow. Well, I know I'm going to go to Europe, but you know, I'll just stay here and take care of the savings alone. Winnie the Pooh is another good example of this character. And I'm using what I call flat characters because they are the extremes. It's easier to see the compulsive behavior and the characteristics in flat characters that are created, because real people are not this simple. So don't think you're Clint Eastwood just because you think you're a champion. But you may have run into people that you think are a lot like Clint Eastwood. How does this guy back off? Why doesn't she just tone it down? Give me a chance. You can notice the self-identity for the nine is, I am peaceful. Go with the flow. I think the book I'm Okay, You're Okay, probably penned by a negotiator. It's okay. You'll hear that come up a lot when they're talking. Well, don't worry, it's okay. Take that dirt big mountain and smooth it out. Take the ripples and smooth them out. Keep it all nice and calm. Flow with it. Don't make waves. Keep the peace at all costs. However, sometimes you don't want to keep the peace. Because if you're keeping the peace and you're flowing and you're coming up on a waterfall, that may not be the best thing to do. The Inspector One defines themselves as being hardworking. So the Inspector has a way of looking at the world and picking out what could be improved almost immediately. If this was a little crooked, the Inspector might come up and go, that's bad. Or if you show them a beautiful flag, and it's gorgeous with all the beautiful color, they're the ones that will come up to it closely and go, do you realize there's a thread hanging off? Or when they're getting out of their car, they'll walk away and pick out their handkerchief and wipe off that little fingerprint. The gift of the Inspector is to be able to discern problems, usually before they become enormous. They are very good editors. These people have a very good sense of what is right and what is not right. For them, it's a matter of what is right and wrong. For the champion, it's a matter of what is fair and not fair. Different ways of using the gun. The Inspector says, I feel this is right. Okay, this is primarily gut-centered, secondarily heart. So they tend to see something wrong and feel obliged to change it. There is this sense of, I am the idealist, and this is my ideal, and everyone must strive to meet this ideal, and I will lead. I will take the banner, and I will go forth. And everyone will follow me, and even if they don't, I will get this done. One of the problems that the Inspector has is that they think by working harder, they'll get rewarded. So they work 20 hours extra every week, and they think they're going to get rewarded because of all this hard-working initiative. And they're getting there, and they're staying late, and everybody else is going home. And instead of getting rewarded, all they get is more work. Because they're so efficient. Quality control. Efficiency. The Inspectors really like this idea. Well, quality control, what a wonderful idea. I can tell people what's wrong with this, and they'll fix it. On the downside, things aren't perfect. We live in an imperfect world. We are imperfect people. We have personalities. We have differences. And the ones pretty much graduated from college, part of the fraternity of shoulda, coulda, woulda. Shoulda done this differently. Coulda done that better. Would have done this if I had the chance. There's always the missed opportunity, the way to improve. Now, if you're working on a computer program, having the ability to discern which number is wrong, or which semicolon is in the wrong place, or which line needs to be changed can be a real benefit. But when you're talking to another human being, picking them apart can be disastrous. Has this ever happened to you? You're talking to somebody and they look at you and go, do you know that there's something on your glasses? Can anybody give me an example of who you think an inspector might be from something we might have all seen, literature or movies? Felix Unger comes to mind from The Odd Couple. Just usually dressed impeccably, all the accessories are matching, everything's in place. But God, Oscar, you're such a slob. And Oscar is a slob. That's why the show is so funny. You take these two extremes and you put them in the same place. Happens frequently in theater, in movies. How many saw When Harry Met Sally? A movie with Meg Ryan and Billy Crystal, now several years ago. In the movie, Meg Ryan plays this woman who's pretty much stuck in this perspective. She's a real caricature of what this inspector does. There's a scene where she's mailing letters in the mailbox. And there's some overtalk going on, there's some storyline being given. And she's got the pile of letters, they're all stamped. Now she knows they're stamped. But she takes them, she opens the mailbox, she puts one in, closes the mailbox, opens the mailbox, takes the next one, puts it in, closes the mailbox, and she's like checking them 100 times to make sure they're all right. Don't want to have them, make sure they all go down one at a time. And Billy Crystal's standing there with her, by the way, he's not acting the inspector in this role. He just takes all the letters, shoves them in the box, and closes the drawer. And she gets mad at him. One of the is, I need to be perfect. They can be viewed as perfectionists. They never give up. They're tenacious. That tenacity is very useful, but at the same time can be a big problem because they don't allow themselves to get angry. Because anger is a messy feeling. I don't want to feel angry. And have you ever run into someone and you go, gosh, you look a little angry? They go, I'm not angry. And you go, well, I mean, I know what just happened would upset me, but you're not even the least bit angry? I'm not angry. And it gets deeper and deeper until finally you're like, I think I better leave the room. And your head's going to pop. Now, you may recognize people you know as you're going through here. That's what I first did when I heard the system. And tempting though it is to tell them, I know what you are. Don't do it.
Come on.
Especially if they're a one. I actually had somebody in a workshop come to me and they identified themselves as an inspector. They said, isn't there any number better than one?
I think it's a great number.
And I just said, well, hold that thought. Okay. Moving around to the outside, the assistant, okay, we're moving into the heart center now. Okay, look at your sheet that talks about the heart center. Heart center is really identified with relationship. How do I feel? What am I feeling? How do you feel? How am I in relationship to you? The heart center kind of keeps us all from being mountain men and living by ourselves. There's this need for community, this need for connectedness. And our heart center gives us feedback in relationship to our jobs, to each other, to children, spouses, dogs, cats, to Holden Village. I mean, you come up here and it's like, I feel like, I feel connected, and we have a chance to get to know each other and share dinner and do these things, and the heart center is really where that's concerned. The next style is what I call doing to. The assistant to defines themselves as being helpful. I am helpful. The service is one of the reasons we're all here at all. If we didn't have people in our lives that went out of their way to meet our needs, we'd never get served in restaurants. We would probably not have done very well in the hospital. We would have a terrible time as children. So this ability to meet other people's needs is very important. Mother Teresa is a real good example of someone who says, I'm going to set everything aside and meet someone else's needs. Now one of her needs, of course, is to meet other people's needs. And that's the paradox of having the two style is, I will take my needs, set them here, and meet your needs. And I will do that to the point where I'm reluctant to meet my needs, my real needs, my creative needs, my heartfelt needs, because what's more important to me is my relationship with you. The assistant walks into a situation and says, can I get you something? Now maybe they need to sit down and take their notes out of your bed, but are you sure there's something I can do? Maybe if I helped you with the overhead, I can get that out for you. Sit up and start tidying up. That's a compulsive thing. When they start helping, help, what I define help as is when somebody asks for help and you give it to them, that's help. But when somebody doesn't ask you for help, and that person starts, and you start to help, then you've sort of intruded into their space and said, I'm going to do this for you whether you want me to or not. And there's this way that the assistant has of being very supportive, but they're not very good at standing up for what they want because they haven't taken the time to figure out what it is they want. It's very common for mothers especially, and some fathers, to get into taking care of their children so much, and getting so wrapped up in that child's life, that they forget about their own life. Or so into taking care of their husband or their wife, that they forget that they have their own needs. So I will bend my schedule to meet your schedule. And I will have this secret need inside that you will bend to meet my schedule, but I'm never going to tell you that. Never. Because if I tell you what my need is, and you don't meet that need, then I'll feel terrible. So it's better for me to try to meet your need, because then at least I'll feel useful. The assistants look for what I call one basic thing. They want to be appreciated. I have a wonderful woman who works as a secretary. There's 9 of us in my office. And she's what I call, I said, the company works for you. Because if you're not here, we're all going to fly off and we're not going to have a company. And she's the secretary. But she's called the administrative assistant, the business manager. And there's all these different euphemisms that go with it. And I found out something interesting last week about the word secretary. Does anybody know where it came from? The etymology of the word.
Secret.
It basically means the keeper of the secrets. I thought that gave me a whole new perspective on what it meant to be an assistant. An assistant is somebody that you trust, a secretary, somebody that you trust with your secrets. So who has the power? The person with the secret or the person keeping the secret? Yeah. So if I'm an assistant, and I end up being your executive secretary, and I know we're all the dirtiest, you better be really nice to me. Because I know Geraldo's number, and I'll call it. and in a way, it's a way of enjoying the power without having to be exposed. The Cardinal Richelieu behind the throne. The CIA behind the president. It's this way of having the power and knowing you have it, and being able to use it. So, in some ways, assistants have been called manipulative because they have this power, they have this ability, and they weave their way into situations where they think, fine, if you don't appreciate me, try and do it without me. And oh my God, you almost can't, because they know where everything is, they know where everybody is, and they've hidden the Rolodex. Now, moving around into the next part of the gut center.
They have the only backup on the disc.
By the way, where's that disc? I just can't remember. But if you took me to lunch, I might remember it, you know. Or they leave, and then you said, we don't need your help anymore. They're fine. And they just smile and leave. And then you realize that the discs are gone. That nobody knows. Maybe they're still there someplace. Where's that file? The administrator 3, I struggled with this word administrator because I think that the administrator is more of an organizer. The administrator 3 style is one of setting the goal and reaching it. They are very involved with their internal goals. This is what I'm going to do, and I know how to get you to come along with me. Where the 8 is the champion can be a very strong leader because of their way of confronting issues and going straight through them. The organizer or the administrator 3 has a way of getting you into it and changing your mindset so that you go along with that. Now, if I want to be president, I need to convince you that I should be president. If I want to sell you a car, I need to convince you that this is the car you should have. 3s have been known to be propagandizers. They have a way of becoming so enmeshed with their subject or their goal. Now, if I'm a car salesman, for example, my goal might be to get that commission. I'm thinking downstream that I want to be in Barbados on vacation. So in order to do that, I have to sell so many cars. By the way, I'm glad you're here to buy a car. And you tell me what kind of car you want. And I go, you know, that's a really nice car. But have you considered this one? Because I get a $500 commission on this car, no $100 commission on this one. But have you considered this car? Do you know how good you would look driving this car? Look at the stereo system. Now this one has a radio, but you can't get FM. But look at this cassette stereo. And you drive off the lot in a new car feeling really good about yourself, but something in the back of your head says, wait a minute, what happened here? Examples of the administrator might be the Iacocca. I'm here to save Christ. Won't you help us pull this out of this slump? Comes on national TV with, it's just him in a suit talking. And pretty soon Chrysler's coming up out of the dumps because he's appealed to us on an emotional level. Threes tend to hit us, or the administrators, don't try to convince us logically. They come into where feelings are. And the hard thing about it, if you notice where they are in the diagram, is that they're in the center. They're at the part of the heart center that's equidistant from the gut and the head. So they tend to have their agenda topmost in their hearts. How they feel is very important, and what they're looking for is recognition. They define themselves as being successful. I am successful. It's successful. They want to feel the success, but they want you to tell them they're successful. So drive the fancy car, wear the expensive suit, have the fancy job, spend, and have this image, which for this particular style becomes so involving that their biggest fear is failure. They identify with the project, with the sale, with the concern, with the goal, that if it falls down and just fails, as some things will do, they think they're failures. So the hard part is, I'm successful, but I failed. But I'm successful. And they will drop down and lose that enthusiasm, that spark that can make you buy a team. You can sell almost anything. They're very good in sales, they're very good in marketing because they know how to appeal to people. And we need this. We need this part of our personality because it's a very good way of getting our needs met. When it's overdeveloped, we can maybe think too much of ourselves and not so much about the group. I think there was a lot of three energy running amok back in the 60s when the whole credit thing got started. Buy now, pay later. Don't worry about it. Don't worry. You can use this. Look how good you'll feel if you have this. And we go, yeah, you're right. Snap it down. Oh, by the way, we're going to charge you 1.5% a month for the rest of your life. And now we're paying the price of that me, the 70s and the me issue, which was my needs first, which was very different from the way the assistant would act, which was your needs first. We tend to be moving more into that now, where it's more of a, we're thinking more about the group and about the environment and about what we're doing. We're starting to take more concern. And holding, I think, is a good way of experiencing that. We're cut up your orange peels before you throw them away. And, I mean, as much as we're kind of a dumb thing to do, until you have gone through the garbology part of this place and you realize how important it is. Other examples of administrators. President Clinton seems to be using that very much. His goal was to be president. With Hillary, I love the relation there. And maybe John F. Kennedy. Just the persona, the charisma. Threes have this charisma. They're almost mesmerizing. You just want to believe it. God, that just sounds great. I love this. You're not even sure why you like it, or if you really like it. But they have a way of sort of sugarcoating it, saying this is a good thing. Follow me. My cause is a worthy cause. And we're going to get there together. Trouble is when they finally get there, they don't give you very much credit. They'll take the credit because that's what they feel important. This is my project at the end of the project instead of our project. When the threes are being fairly healthy, it becomes our project. They make their people look good, and what they finally understand is if they make their people look good, they look good. The issue comes when they start feeling like they have to look good at all costs. It becomes real damage. Moving around to the other end of the heart center, okay, here we are, primarily heart, secondarily head. We're internal for the most part. The hardest thing for them to do is use the gut. It's the least integrated, so they're not as expressive. The author for is is sometimes seen as, they define themselves as being unique. I am unique. I am incredibly unique. I am so extraordinary that ordinary shouldn't be part of the word. I am illustrious. I am extreme. And it's this feeling that they have to be different from everyone else that causes them so much grief. Example of a four might be Jackie Kennedy. There's this sense that she's otherworldly, etheric. There's this quality of artist, just, you know, artist, the aesthetic. They're very aesthetic, very art prone. Individuals tends to describe them very well, and they like to stand out in the crowd. In a group of teenagers, let's say, standing on a street corner, and they're dressed up in the grunge clothing with the combat boots and the raggy shirts and terribly looking awful. Oh, God, you wouldn't want to be near them. You can always pick out the artist four in the group because they're dressed like college prep. Even in a group that's trying to be extreme, this person has to be an individual. Another example might be at a fancy dress ball, black tie affair, women in black evening gowns, men in tuxes with black ties. You'll see some individuality around the room, but not very much. You can always find the artist because there will be something about their outfit that stands out and commands attention. Maybe diamond-studded sandals instead of black shoes. Maybe one earring. Something, maybe a very fine gold necklace. Something that would totally get your attention from the rest of the room. The one thing about the artist that's difficult is that they live in an emotional spectrum that's very extreme. In order to feel extraordinary, they can't feel ordinary emotions and feel like it's okay. So there's a sense of, I'm really joyful, I'm ecstatic, I can reach that high. Joyful. Or I'm incredibly sad. And the thing is, when you see them, you're not sure if they're going up or down through the scale. That they're somewhere, when they hit where we live, which is, how are you feeling today? I'm feeling pretty good. The four would say, I'm feeling outstanding, how are you today? There's this over emotionality that draws them out, and because they're feeling so good, you go, wow, that's great. But when they're feeling really bad, you know, we get just, I'm feeling kind of sad today, you know, I ran over a chipmunk. I feel sad. The four would say, I ran over a chipmunk. I'm thinking of turning myself in. I've taken life from the planet. I've sinned against God and creation. And there's this sin, and they go on. It's like the more they talk about how bad they feel, the worse they feel, the more extreme the feeling, the better they feel. Now we think of better as feeling happier. It's this intensity of feeling that the four seeks. And it's not bad, it's just, you know, think of your actors. For fours, it's much easier for the artist to take on a role that's been written. There are some actors that are so good at playing other people, they don't play themselves very well. So the artist dramatizes everything. It's like this incredible need to be bigger than life. What could be bigger than life than being 7 feet tall on a flat screen? And you can do it without being there. You can get your face up in front of millions of people and you can still be at home. It's an ability to act out without having to confront people. The hardest thing for the four to do really is to express themselves as they truly are, which is much like the rest of us, without having that need to be extreme. I talked about when Harry met Sally, Billy Crystal plays this role, does four very well in this movie, as he practices his moaning in bed. Sally's talking to him and she goes, well, how are you feeling? She says, what are you doing? He says, I'm practicing my moaning. This lamenting that's going on and on. Meryl Streep plays movies with four characters out of Africa. French Lieutenant's Woman. These almost wistful beings that kind of come in and go out. Dead Poets Society is another film. The young man who plays the actor, who plays Puck in Shakespeare, he wants to be an actor. His father, who is a very upset member, Inspector White. Your mother and I are expecting you to be a doctor. You're going to be a doctor. That's the way it is. You're going to quit the newspaper. You're going to quit this acting business, and you're going to a military academy. just takes the four and goes. And so at the end of the movie, the four takes on this role of Puck, and he's standing in this window, and he takes his crown of thorns, or the crown that he had as the actor, and he takes this thing off in a very dramatic moment. He takes this off and sets it in the window, goes downstairs, and shoots himself in the head. But it's this thing that he took his spirit off. He completely stepped out of his reality. He was not a person anymore. He was a character. He walked downstairs and ended his life. Totally. That was the whole point of the movie, was this whole coming of age business. But in that moment, you really see how the four is struggling with just being okay. You know, it was the father that had the problem in the movie. The boy was just being born. Now, fours are not all negative and depressing. I mean, don't let me get that to you. They're very happy people, but again, look for the extremes. As we move over to the head center, we have here the Sage Five. The Sage defines themselves as being knowing. I am knowledgeable. I am like a library. Come to me, read through my card file, and you will find anything you know. Please don't let it be a topic I don't know anything about. Fives are very good at explaining. They explicate when they communicate. If you ask them a question and they know the answer, be prepared to get a long answer. And you say, that's fine, I've had enough. Oh, no, no. I'm sure you're not smart enough to understand this. Let me explain it a different way. Well, one more analogy and we'll go. There is this tendency to move forward and almost hold the information in a miserly way. Like, well, I'll give you a little information. Oh, you want to know what I know about? Well, let me boom inside your balls all over you. These fives tend to be people, or people who do the five, let me explain that, are really good at picking up information everywhere and collating it. They just seem to know, they put it here, they remember a lot of things, what I would call extraneous data, like who was the star of Gilligan's Island, and what was the winning score of the 1929 World Series. There's just like all this data that's stuck in them, and they don't know how to get rid of it. But it keeps them warm in the middle of the night. These are, again, have you ever seen an argument or experienced something between a four and a five? Where the four is trying to get the five to understand how they feel, and the five is like trying to get them to understand. Well, why are you feeling that?
And the four goes,
and the five gets more and more and starts chasing the four with questions. Well, tell me more about it. When did you start feeling this? The four is feeling like, oh God, hurt me some more. And there's, it just goes on. It's the kind of thing where in an argument where you can see the polarization, they pull apart. Now you're facing it. An example of the five, William F. Buckley, Mario Cuomo, real cool. This cool. The idea that the head center really needs to have this warmth developed, that they can interact more with people. It's very difficult for the head center to realize why people are important. It's the information that's important. I've heard the information, it's mine now. Would you please get to the point and let me get at it? There's more to learn. I could go to the Portal Museum and read all the books on geology today. Yoda from Star Wars, very good five, lives by himself on a little planet out someplace else and gives out these little nuggets of wisdom. Plus the horse. Robin Williams in Awakenings is a good example of the five. He's been studying worm farms for how many years, and he goes to get a job working with people who are what? Sleeping. He wants to work with people who are sleeping. Then he can lecture and have a captive audience. And then he finds out, when he's taking all of his knowledge and applying it, wake these people up and what's going on, and they go through this point where he actually starts to develop this warmth and this caring about other people, and it becomes pretty much a real dynamic force. And then they realize that there's nothing they can do, and they all eventually go back to sleep. It's a sad movie, but you watch him grow and change within this. That information is not reality. Knowledge is not power. Applying knowledge is power. Application, you know, having the knowledge is almost useless. Unless you're giving it to somebody else. I'll go over to the facilitator real quick. Again, the facilitator six defines themselves as being, I am loyal. What's important for the facilitator is the group. As long as the group is okay, I'm okay. And I'm going to be on the alert and on the lookout for anything that's going to affect this group. Sixes like causes. Sixes draw their power from another authority. Sixes insist you play by the rules. The ones make the rules, but the sixes insist everybody play by them so we maintain our cohesiveness. Sixes are very community oriented. You'll find them, they make great office managers. Just terrific because they're aware of where everybody is and they like to make sure the group's needs are met. But this is different from the assistant too, who's interested in your one-on-one needs. What can I get for you? The six would say, what can I get for us? Is everybody comfortable? Can we do this differently? Is this bright enough? Can everybody read this? The two might say, you in the back, can you read this? Subtle differences. Both concerned about people, but remember the two is concerned about your needs and how they can relate to you. The six is concerned about, are we safe? As a group, are we okay? Which can be good if the cause of the group is just. If the group is headed in the right direction. Otherwise, the facilitator kind of jumps on the bandwagon and goes wherever the group is going, because what's important is being part of it. This, an example of this, I was with a group of people in Seattle. We'd been with the Enneagram. We were walking around. I came to a red light on the street. The whole group was going to jaywalk. Well, in Seattle, it's a $47 ticket if you step into the street when the light's red. And I was watching this, staying back on the curb, watching this whole thing happen. And the whole group starts to cross the street. And there was a policeman. And the policeman walks up behind this guy, who's a six, and says, excuse me, I'm giving you a ticket for jaywalking. And this guy doing six turned around and said, well, everybody else is doing it. Didn't stop him. He still got the ticket. But the idea was, if the group is doing something against the law, well, then so can I. I'm part of this group. I identify with the group. It's the individuality that's difficult because they've been told, do this because I tell you to. They defer to the authority. Okay. I'll give a good example. Luke Skywalker from Star Wars. I'm going to join the Rebel Alliance and beat the Empire at their own game. I'm going to do this. And he doesn't believe in himself. When Yoda's saying, raise the ship out of the swamp, Luke's trying, and the ship starts to come up out of the swamp, and he says, it's just too hard, I can't do it, it's too hard. And the ship sinks back into the swamp. And so Yoda, in his sage mentality, sits down there and raises the ship out of the swamp, and tells Luke, you give up. You don't believe in yourself. That's why you fail. And it takes Luke two more movies to figure out that he has this power, that he is a Jedi Knight, and man, I'm pretty good at it too. He has to go through the realization that Darth Vader's his father. Oh, wow, I've been living in a dream. Well, you're not even real, Luke. Don't worry about it. But when the six comes forth and they really bring their gift in, which is the ability to feel like they are their own authority, that it's okay, there's a sense of nervousness. Some people think sixes are anxious and fearful, and I disagree. People doing six are just very alert. They're very alert about what's going on around them. They take in everything, but they juggle. They try to keep everything open all the time, and they're keeping it moving. I'll tell one more six story, then I'll move on to the seventh. I was at a Dairy Queen in Cleveland, Ohio. There are Dairy Queens in Cleveland. And there were a bunch of people. We were studying the Enneagram. We were going through our certification course. And we had an A, a 2, a 3, and a 1, and an A. And this woman who was doing 6 just perfectly. We walked into Dairy Queen. And everybody went through an order. Well, of course, the woman as 6 is going last. I'll call her Ivy. And she's reading the whole menu. And the little gal behind the counter goes, hi, welcome to Dairy Queen. Can I help you? She goes, I'll have a sundae. Would you like vanilla ice cream, chocolate ice cream, or strawberry ice cream? So there's like a few more data, so she's sitting there doing these. And I'm looking and she's staring and thinking, she's almost out loud. Vanilla. Would you like chocolate sauce, marshmallow sauce, sprinkles, or a cherry? And she was like, all this information kept coming in, and all she needed to do was order dessert. But she had to take everything into consideration, think about it, pull it all in. just not fudge, please. And then she got her dessert and she was happy. But there was this process. Each one of our personality styles is a process we go through to get these things taken care of. The six wants to make sure, she looks around to see what everybody else is having. If we were all having Sundays, she'd have a Sunday. But we all had something different, so we did. Let's cut and go with it. The last type is the optimist seven. Now, sevens define themselves as being fun, being nice, being enthusiastic, always ready to go. People view sevens sometimes as being flighty, not quite with it, disconnected from reality. Because they don't see see things the way everybody else does. The example I use for the seven is Julie Andrews as Maria von Trapp in The Sound of Music. She's just been kicked out of the abbey. The Mother Superior said, not only am I kicking you out, you're going to be a governess for seven children. And a captain who's a real Inspector One. And she says, I've got confidence in sunshine. And she's dancing through the streets of Salzburg with her guitar and kicking up her heels and moving through this. And you're like, wow, I wish I could do that. And this, you think, okay, so you go back into the movie and she meets the children and she's a little distraught because the captain's blowing this whistle and calling all these children by his signals. And then there's this big storm and she starts singing about the thunder and the lightning and these are a few of my favorite.